Hey, everybody. We're going to start another lecture here. We're talking about precious metals and gems. So this is a really interesting subject. There's so many different metals, precious metals, and gems. We're going to talk about more gems in this class because gemstones are really interesting, including diamond and others. But in terms of precious metals, I'm going to focus on the one you see right here, gold. Okay, gold is especially interesting. It's got a lot of different uses, has a really interesting history, and it also is found in a large variety of geologic environments. Okay, the geology of how you find gold, where it exists in the earth, where it's concentrated, is also really interesting and highly varied, really diverse. Okay, so let's look at gold. We're going to sort of dive into this one just as an example of one of the precious metals that's out there. Gold, of course, the elemental symbol is AU. It is element number 79, and this is a picture of about a 1 ounce gold nugget that was found up in Alaska in a placer deposit, which we're going to be talking about placer deposits here in just a little bit. Okay, so gold. Well, there's a lot of different things to say about gold, right? It has industrial uses. You know, you guys see some things that are painted here. This is actually really interesting, these images of gold in its crystalline form. Remember, a mineral, which gold can also be a mineral. A mineral means that you have a specific chemical composition in a specific orderly pattern, right? It's organizing itself in a certain pattern. That's the definition of a mineral. And you can see gold is shown in its mineral form here. Really interesting. Here's some gold that's shown on a quartz crystal. Of course, it exists in jewelry, etc. And yeah, a lot of other kind of interesting, kind of fun information in this little blurb here. Okay, let's look at the geology of gold, where it forms. So one of the things I've talked about quite a bit already is groundwater. And groundwater is key for concentrating minerals, and gold is no exception. Okay, the gold ore is concentrated in the subsurface in a lot of different ways, but there's really two things that need to be present. You need to have water circulating in the subsurface. So groundwater, right? It needs to be moving around in the subsurface. And in order for it to be moving around and precipitating or concentrating gold, you need to have a source of heat. And that heat can come in a lot of different forms. And that's kind of what's shown in all these different images here. There's a lot of different ways you can get heat, right? You can get a magma chamber that exists in the subsurface. And this is actually showing one under the ocean. There are these things called mid-oceanic ridges, which are underneath the oceans. And these are chains of volcanoes with magma close to the surface. And so you have water that's circulating through the rock in these locations because of this heat source and all this water that exists. You can also have it in a place like the Cascades, right? Here's this first image shows a volcano here, and this is on land. And you can have, you know, faults that exist to provide pathways for water to move. You have precipitation. Hey, we're no stranger to that in the Pacific Northwest. You have precipitation that falls on the mountains. That's called meteoric water. That's why this is called the meteoric water system. So when the water's coming from the clouds, ultimately from precipitation, we call that meteoric water. And that's going to fall and infiltrate into the subsurface, and then it's going to heat up as it gets down deeper into the subsurface because we have something called the geothermal gradient, right? Which is regardless of whether you have a magma chamber in the subsurface or not. In the case of a volcano, you do. Okay, but in this lower picture, for example, there's no magma down here. This doesn't show any volcanoes. But regardless, when you go down into the subsurface, it still heats up. Okay, that's called the geothermal gradient, and the average for the Earth is somewhere around 25 degrees Celsius per kilometer. So if you start going down, it's going to start heating up. If you have magma, it's going to heat up even quicker, right? But in the volcano case, okay, so meteoric water falls, it infiltrates into the subsurface, it starts heating up, and that creates convection, that creates circulation of that groundwater, and so it starts moving around. And that's going to be key, again, for concentrating gold, creating gold ore in the subsurface. And it might be focused along veins, like shown in this image here. Okay, you have other veins coming off out of this magma chamber. Meteoric water, again, circulating around from this heat source. You also have potentially juvenile water, which is water that is coming from the magma chamber itself. So juvenile is different from meteoric. There is actually water in the magma as well. And that water also can circulate and concentrate gold. Okay, we're going to look at that a little bit more in a moment. But first, let's look at where gold is being produced throughout the world. So we have a couple different precious metals shown here. Gold at the top. We also have silver, platinum, etc. But if you look at different countries, China, Australia, the United States, and Russia, this is production in terms of metric tons. Okay, so 420 metric tons of gold. That's a lot. If you think about it, that's a lot of gold. And that's this is their reserves, right? So they have quite a few reserves. Australia's got a lot of reserves of gold. Okay, they're producing a bit less at just a slower rate ultimately compared to China. The United States is up there. Russia's up there. So what's in common with all four of these countries, these high-producing countries? What's common is that they're all massive. They're all very large countries, right? So in other words, the more land space you have, the more potential you have to you know, own all of these natural resources like gold that can be very valuable. Okay, so different countries here producing gold. Let's look and see what the change in price has been over the last couple decades. So you can see from 1960 up to 2010 is shown here up to about maybe 2012 is where this graph ends. And a couple different things are shown here. So gold is going to be this kind of gray, solid gray curve. And look at what happened sometime after the year 2000. It just popped up. If you had bought gold right here, you would be rocking out right now. If you put all your money into gold in 2000, that's an 18% return on investment from 2000 to 2012, which is much better than like the stock market, for example, normally does. But if you had bought gold in 1980, right here at this peak, you would have actually lost money between then and 2000. So these things are tough to predict. Generally, gold ends up being more expensive. Okay, when the economy feels unstable, when there's a recession, for example, the price of gold tends to go up. It feels like a safe place for people that have money to put their money as opposed to the stock market, which at those times during recessions can feel more volatile. So the price of gold is quite volatile. But yeah, it has seen an incredible increase in value along with silver. Also, it's this solid black curve here. PGEs, that's platinum group elements. So these are a lot of the other precious metals that were being mentioned. And then gems like diamonds are shown here, this sort of dotted line. Diamond value, I mean, also has increased, but not at the same level as gold, right? Very interesting. And then this is this sort of thicker gray curve here is the consumer price index, just to give you a sense of whether or not these things are increasing more or less than inflation, okay, just standard inflation over time. Okay, and yeah, interestingly, silver kind of followed inflation here. Diamonds, to some degree, just outpaced it a little bit, but gold is definitely an outlier, at least throughout that period of time here. So just bringing another image in here, this is the change in production since 1960. So we went from price now on the left. That's what we were just looking at, right? Now we're going to look at production on the right. And interestingly, see gold here. It's this gray, solid curve again. Since about 1990 or even 2000, production has not increased. It's been pretty constant. Okay, so imagine this is really the supply side, right? So imagine if demand is increasing, but production is not increasing along with demand. What happens? Well, the price skyrockets. The price goes up, right? So those two things are very much related. You can see silver kind of has a similar thing going on here. And this curve here is going to be iron. Which is just for a reference, really. But yeah, I already mentioned this 18% return on investment if you had bought gold in 2001 and then sold it in 2012. Okay, these things are, you know, if you have a crystal ball, okay, good luck. So gold occurrence, native gold, it's going to be AU. We already mentioned that. This is a nice picture here of gold in its native form. We also have electrum. We're going to look at an example of that in just a moment. It's ultimately gold and silver. It's a gold-silver alloy. Telluride minerals, this is also a form that it can take, and we're going to look at how that expresses itself. Comes from some of the mines in Colorado, as you might expect if you're familiar with where telluride is. And then the geologic setting, right? Hydrothermal. Okay, this is what we were looking at in terms of finding places in the subsurface where you have a heat source like magma, or you could just be going down into the earth where the geothermal gradient increases heat, but you have water moving around, right? Okay, that's going to be about 57% of your gold mines. bit close behind, right? Not far behind are what we call placer deposits. This guy, placer deposits. And these are ultimately sedimentary deposits, okay? These are loose sediments oftentimes that are deposited in streams. They can be deposited in deltas, right? Wherever you get sediments accumulating, okay, you're going to have gold being deposited in those because ultimately the hydrothermal areas where these where the gold is being formed and concentrated in the subsurface, at some point those deposits get exposed at the surface in mountains and they start eroding away, right? And so as that stuff erodes, it's turning into sand grains, etc., and it's being transported down streams. And so that gold is being moved from its source, which people would call back in the day the mother lode, right? It's being moved from there downstream, and that ends up being a placer deposit. And that's kind of the classic, like, old school images of California gold rush and stuff. Mainly what people are doing there is mining placer deposits, streams, like panning for gold, right? That would be a placer deposit. Okay, so electrum, I just mentioned this. It's an alloy of silver and gold. This is sort of an image that shows it in its natural form. Okay, probably mixed in with some quartz here is my guess. It's pretty typical mineral to find in these veins along with gold. And then electrum was used back in the day for early coinage. So yeah, quite a history there. Telluride minerals, I also mentioned this, right? This is where gold is occurring with tellurium, which is another element, right? And it depends on, well, we'll look at an image here in just a second that shows how that can change. But some examples would be in a phonolite or calaverite, different types of telluride minerals, right, where gold is found. And so just as an example, some of these telluride minerals, so, you know, this is a very typical way to show composition of minerals in geology using this thing. It's called a ternary diagram in ternary three, right? It's a triangle. And at each corner of the triangle, you have a different element. So tellurium, TE, you have gold down here, and then you have silver over here. And so wherever you plot within this triangle, that just tells you, like, what is your relative proportion of those three different elements. And so each of these minerals that are shown here, like calaverite, I just mentioned that one, right? Sylvanite, pelzite, all these different minerals that are on here have different proportions of tellurium, gold, and silver to make that mineral. So in Colorado, for example, in some of these mines where you have telluride minerals being mined for gold, right, you're going to be mining actually these minerals, and then you're going to use some process after the fact to extract the gold from that mineral. And we'll talk about that as well. Okay, so just another image that kind of shows what, you know, and this also comes from the reading, which you should see, but shows the whole system. And you know, I mean, it's very complicated looking, but in reality, it is because gold is found in so many different types of geologic environments. Epithermal, okay, this is a term that's really just talking about hydrothermal systems. So systems where you have water and heat, hydrothermal, moving around in the subsurface, and epithermal just meaning that a lot of it's happening kind of at shallow levels, in that it's taking meteoric water, right? Water that's coming from clouds as precipitation that's infiltrating into the subsurface, interacting with some heat source, and then it's sort of turning around, convecting, right, and moving through the system then to cooler areas, so shallower levels. Those would be epithermal, so we're kind of near the surface. And then orogenic is another fancy geologic word, which just refers to an area where you have mountain building. That's the fancy term for mountain building in geology. And whenever you have mountain building, you have rocks that are colliding together and getting squished and pushed together so that you create mountains, right? You end up creating relatively thick piles of crust. And in doing so, you can create fractures and you get folds in that rock as it collides and comes together. You get metamorphic rocks as rocks get pushed downward and they start getting heated up. They start changing their crystal structure, etc. And in that case, you know, you're getting heating and, you know, you have fluids again that are moving through this, just groundwater fluids. And as they do so, you're getting gold concentrated along veins, etc. Okay, we'll look at that a little bit more. Okay, so epithermal gold deposits. Start with that piece, relatively low temperatures is kind of funny. I put it in quotes because low temperature in this case, we're talking 200 to 300 degrees C. That's still pretty warm, right? We're at 1 kilometer depth. And so, you know, if you think about it, you know, that's, it's from the Earth's perspective, that's pretty shallow. Okay, I mean, 1 kilometer is a pretty long distance to actually move. If you think about it, that, you know, we'll look at this in a second, but some of the deepest gold mines out there, up to 4 kilometers, even over 4 kilometers deep. So you can get pretty deep out there. But 1 kilometer depth, you know, getting up to hundreds of degrees C. Remember, the geothermal gradient, I already mentioned, this is about 25 degrees C per kilometer. So in this case, in the case of epithermal gold deposits, if you're going 1 kilometer down, we're not only at 25 degrees C, right? We're higher than that. So you probably have another source of heat, like a magma body, okay? Maybe you're in a volcanic terrain or something where you got these other sources of heat that are causing it to get relatively warm. Okay, we have different types of epithermal gold deposits. Magmatic fluid, okay, this is the juvenile fluid, so stuff that's not meteoric, not coming from rain and such. You have fluid that's actually in the magma that's moving around. It ends up being relatively acidic. You can have meteoric water influence, so that's where the rainwater is infiltrating, as I mentioned. And then you can also have this Carlin type, AG, that's actually supposed to be AU, sorry, is in solid solution within, and I can't actually see what that says because of me, I'll remove myself. Solid solution within a form of pyrite, right? Pyrite is also known as fool's gold. It looks a lot like gold, but it's not, okay? But you can actually have gold in solid solution with pyrite. So that's a really interesting situation, right, where you have gold that exists within fool's gold. So in that case, it's not really. But you'd still have to extract it. That would be the Carlin type of a gold deposit, okay? Okay, gold throughout the world, my gosh, you can, you know, like I said, if it's going to exist in a lot of different geologic environments, it's probably going to exist all over the world, and it does. But notice, you know, some of the concentrated areas here would be kind of right along kind of the edge of Western North America, Central America, the Andes, etc. And what do these have in common? Right, this is the Ring of Fire. Okay, this is a volcanic chain ultimately that runs all the way down the west coast of North America, South America, and then it continues and goes all the way around the Pacific Ocean, way over there. So, you know, this is a volcanic chain. We got a source of heat. That was one important piece. But you don't have to be in a volcanic chain to find gold. You can also get it in the middle of the United States, the Midwest, in the middle of Canada, down here in South Africa. This is definitely not a volcanic chain down here. And it, Witwatersrand is one of the largest gold deposits in the world. We're going to look at that a little bit more. You get it all over the place in Asia as well, in Australia. So really gold is distributed throughout the world. And part of the reason, again, is because it's found in such a wide variety of geologic environments. It's really hard to just sort of summarize and say, oh yeah, this is what you look for when you try to find gold, because it has a really large diversity of areas that it's found. So I mentioned in the Carlin type, you know, this is where it's going to be substituting within another mineral, whether it's pyrite or something else. And there's a couple of ways this can happen. This is why I'm showing this image. It just kind of gives you a sense of how that works. So you can substitute, so you can get gold substituting for other elements within that mineral. Okay, so you have the mineral structure and you have a certain chemical composition, then gold comes along and just sort of replaces every once in a while an element in there. And you can also have it interstitial. Okay, this is another form of solid solution, right, where it exists within the pre-existing crystal matrix, okay, between other elements. Okay, that's also a possibility. And this would be an example of a Carlin type deposit. And so why are they called Carlin type deposits? So this is an open pit mine, clearly. This one's in Nevada. Let's go ahead and take a look here. I think I have one of these pulled up. Yep. So Google Maps here. All right, this is Google Maps. And right there, well, let's go ahead and zoom in so you can see that a little better. That is Carlin. Okay, this is a small town. Small town of Carlin, and we're in Nevada. I'm going to zoom out far enough so you can see where we're at. Okay, there's Elko just to the right here, just to the northwest. But right here in Nevada, you can see California. Oregon is up here. Salem, Portland. Oh, just above the screen, popping around there. Okay, so let's go ahead and zoom back in to Carlin. So the Carlin-type gold deposits, well, where are those things? Why are they called Carlin? Well, if I zoom out a little bit, look, I got this thing right here. And Gold Quarry Security, okay. They have a good review on Google. Interesting. But regardless, so this is a satellite image, and this is showing a Carlin-type gold mine. So here's your open pit, okay, that we were just looking at a second ago in that image. Okay, this is a Carlin-type deposit, right? So in this case, gold is substituting in for other elements within another mineral, right? And then if I move up along here, oh, look, here's another. Okay, it exists along trends like this. These Carlin deposits generally exist along these kind of linear trends. And in this case, they're kind of going north-south or northwest-southeast. And as we go up here, see, here's another open pit. And this one's got a lot of dark rock in there. It could be like some mudstone or some phyllite, some metamorphosed or lightly metamorphosed mudstone, very typical in these terrains or these sort of gold areas where gold is mined. And it just keeps going, right? More terraces over here. Okay, so this is happening along a trend. Right, you can see it's kind of happening along a trend. That's typical for Carlin type deposits. It's going to be sort of a geologic trend here. The other thing I want to kind of show you here is, let's get back into the slideshow, is, you know, you can find out for, this is the Goldstrike mine specifically, you know, outside of Elko, Nevada, what we're looking at here. Rock solid resources, proven advice. So this is a report that was put together on the gold deposits in this area, these Carlin-type deposits. So I'm going to go ahead and open this report up. We're going to jump to page 47. And this is stuff you can just get online, obviously. You can just search for it and find it. So here's the report. And on page 47, it starts with geologic setting and mineralization. So you have a whole section here on the geology, regional geology, property geology, mineralization, deposit types. I mean, this goes on and on forever. We're not going to look at this whole thing. But this is very interesting, right? It tells you, so this Goldstrike mine, it's located in the Great Basin within the Carlin Trend, okay, in certain mountains here. It's an alignment of gold mines that go northwest to southeast belt, extending 5 miles wide, 40 miles long, and it accounts for more gold production than any other mining district in the United States, so it's very prolific. The northern trends account for an excess of 20 gold mines and deposits, so there's a lot of mining that exists along here. Two regionally recognized assemblages comprise the sedimentary strata of northeastern Nevada, so now we're getting into the geology. This is the part I love. Siliciclastic assemblage consists of mudstone, chert. Chert is a microcrystalline quartz. Siltstone, so this is another type of mudstone ultimately. And minor limestone, including imprecate thrust slices of Devonian, Slavin, Silurian, Elder, Ordovician. These are just names of, these names refer to different ages of rocks. But you can go through here and learn all about, you know, how this gold, the sort of geologic context for, you know, how this gold formed, the year of the rocks. Gold mineralization occurred when volcanism, right, when you had volcanoes that were occurring about 39 million years ago. Okay, so you don't have active volcanoes really in that area much today, but you did, right, 40 million years ago. And when that happened, you had gold that was being concentrated, and that's what's being exposed today and mined today. So this is, again, doesn't have to exist in an active volcanic chain, but oftentimes, like in these deposits, there was a volcanic chain that existed at some point in the past. Okay, and that's what we're seeing here. But yeah, this is really interesting. I actually posted this in the files folder on Canvas, so if you're interested, take a look at it. I mean, as a geologist, I find it pretty interesting. Hopefully, it wouldn't be too too jargony. You know, that's the problem with some of these things, is that it can feel like you need a geology background, a degree to understand a lot of the words, but you could skim it. It might still be interesting. So generally what we're looking at here, again, is we're looking at areas where you have faults. Okay, so we've got pathways for water to move like this, right? Water's going to move along these faults. And then you have layers of rock that exist in here, whether it's sandstone, some limestone that was mentioned. This is an image, right, that shows some of that layered rock, which is pretty cool. And as those waters move through here, okay, they dissolve small trace amounts of gold in some of these surrounding host rocks. And as the pressure temperature regime changes again, those dissolve, that dissolved gold, it can start to precipitate out in veins. And in the Carlin-type deposits, it's a little bit of a different situation where it's substituting, right, into the crystal matrix of another mineral like pyrite. So that's pretty interesting as well. Again, lots of different ways it can form here. This shows another sort of group of really interesting rocks where you have these layered, you know, and these could be mudstones. In this case, we're looking at a limestone. In this case, this one is metamorphosed, right? It's got all that kind of curvy nature to it. That means that you started out with something that was likely flatline, kind of like what we see up here, and then eventually it was subject to pressure so that it started to deform and it started to change and become wavy like this. But you can see that you have fluids that are moving through here and mineralizing along some of those flow pathways. And what's mineralizing out? Well, potentially gold, right? Probably a lot of quartz, maybe some silver, other platinum group elements. But this is where gold can be concentrated. And so, yeah, another really interesting image that shows kind of how these things are forming. So there's a couple different ways that you can get this stuff happening, you know, and again, it's all related to the interaction of water and the surrounding rock. So in the case of limestone coming through here, you might have a vein, which is shown as this plane coming through here. And in all three of these, this is just representing a plane where you have water that's able to move through the system, okay? And as it interacts with the limestone in this case, that's where you get a reaction occurring, and that's where you potentially are either dissolving or precipitating gold, in this case probably precipitating. In another case along the vein, at some point the pressure temperature starts changing to where the pressure goes down, you know, the temperature is going down as you move towards the surface, and at some point it hits a level, right? And that could be where boiling is occurring. So we're going to vapor because the pressure is going down, where all of a sudden those PT conditions, pressure temperature conditions, change so that the gold will start to precipitate out maybe with other minerals along kind of that horizon, that PT pressure temperature horizon. In other cases, you can have mixing of different types of groundwater. It could be magmatic water or juvenile water mixing with meteoric water. That's one possibility. Or just different groundwater coming from different sources, mixing together, changing the chemistry right at that interface, and potentially pressure temperature as well. So you might get it precipitating out along a horizon like this. And so that ends up creating these trends, right? This is why you end up getting trends, you know, like we just saw in Carlin, Nevada up here. These trends kind of go along like this, and it's because maybe you have the intersection of a fault plane or a fracture set with a certain unit that exists kind of along that trend. Or maybe, you know, this is defining the trend, right? The area where you had boiling happening along that vein or that set of veins or fractures. Or this is the trend right here, right? This is where the two water bodies were mixing together, creating a trend over space. Okay, that's how that sort of works. And again, gold is tricky because there's so many different types of environments that it can be deposited in. Another one, just to keep throwing them at you, is porphyry copper deposits. Why am I coming back to copper? We talked about this at the very beginning. Well, it's because gold is also mined in these situations. So this one right here is one we looked at earlier. This is the one right outside of Salt Lake City, Utah. And the primary purpose of this mine is to mine copper. Okay, 237,000 tons of copper is what's being produced out of here. But you also have gold that's coming out. So gold is, you know, it's obviously valuable. It's not the main reason the mine exists, but it just so happens there's also quite a bit of gold in there. And so they go ahead and mine that, and they sell that as well. So this would be a porphyry copper deposit where you're actually producing quite a bit of gold as well, even though that's not the primary reason that the mine exists. Okay, so I mentioned Witwatersrand, South Africa, earlier, because this is one of the most prolific mines of gold in the world. This is an image of Witwatersrand. You can see it's open pit right here, but it's not throughout. There's actually also a bunch of tunnels that go in to great depth, actually 4 kilometers deep. You can see in this bullet, which is about 13,000 feet in the Tautona mine. But there's 41,000 tons have been mined, and that exploration geologists believe that there's about that much still remaining. The problem is that the easy stuff has already been mined. So what's left is kind of lower concentration, you know, stuff that's deeper, et cetera. So that's, you know, it makes it seem like, oh, they got a long ways to go. Well, they do, but it's the stuff that's left is no longer the low-hanging fruit. It's a lot trickier to get what's left. You know, this particular mine is 20 times larger, this resource, 20 times larger than the biggest epithermal deposit. Okay, so this is a really significant source of gold. And when you get down to these great depths, 4 kilometers depth, 13,000 feet, you know, the temperature is really high, 130 degrees Fahrenheit. Nobody can work at that in those conditions. It's just inhumane. So they have to actually install air conditioning systems. And this comes up in some of the videos that you'll be watching, to try to get the temperature down to something reasonable, 82 degrees Fahrenheit. But even so, the humidity ends up being really high. So the working conditions here are just rough. You know, relatively low wages in South Africa, 150,000 laborers, so huge workforce down here, employing a lot of people mining gold that's then exported throughout the world. Let's look at the working aspect of this. So we're going to move a little bit from geology here into the economics. This is pretty fascinating. So Witwatersrand miners make about $15,600, and this is working full-time, right, per person per year. And that is about 10% or a little bit more than 10% than the average wage of an American miner, okay, a North American miner. So they're making a fraction of what people in the United States, like in Carlin, Nevada, for example, would be making, okay, or up in Canada would be making. Yeah, it seems pretty unfair, right? Well, one thing that's kind of interesting to consider when you look at that difference in wage is this graph or table, which comes from the reading as well. And this shows different mines, different companies, right? How much they're producing, how many employees they have. And so, you know, if you take the amount of production and divide it by the number of employees, you get the amount produced per employee. Okay, it's just kind of interesting. So now the bottom ones here, these ones are the South African mines. Harmony is a South African mine. It's the lowest on the list. So you have quite a few employees here, almost 40,000. And they are producing 33 ounces per employee. Now, if you go to the very top of this list, which is, you know, the most produced per employee, Agnico Eagle, well, let's say Newmont, this one is literally those Carlin gold deposits. We're just looking outside of Carlin. This is owned by Newmont. It's the company. And they are producing about 337 ounces per employee. That's 10 times as much per employee as you get in South Africa. Okay, well, why is that, right? And then think about this stat up here. Again, American miners are making, you know, much more, an order of magnitude more, really, than your South African miners. They're also producing an order of magnitude more gold per employee. So the economics, if you think about it just purely from an economic level, they kind of work out, right? And for good or for bad, right? I'm not making a value judgment on this. But why is that the case? Well, there's two things going on here. One I already mentioned, which is that South African gold mining has been happening for a long time. So all the low-hanging fruit has already been grabbed. The stuff that's left is harder to get, okay? So just the number of ounces per employee you're going to be getting in South Africa is going to be less than in places like Carlin, Nevada. It's just a younger the mining there hasn't been going on as long, basically. So that's one piece. The second piece is that the technology is different, right? You have technology that's being employed, automation ultimately in North America that's not being employed in South Africa, that's taking the place of a lot of what would be labor, right? So human labor. So you just don't need as many humans, right, to produce as much gold in North America because you have a lot of machines doing the work for you. So that's also another piece of the equation there. But yeah, so kind of interesting to just look at that, you know, and see how this stuff is being produced in different parts of the world. You're going to see even more extreme example from Southeast Asia in one of the videos that I posted. Okay, so we've been talking about gold as it exists in the subsurface, how it's concentrated in veins, et cetera. But then there's also placer deposits. And we looked at this image before. This shows a lot of sedimentary deposits, how you get sediments being deposited from mountains, right? Glaciers can do it, sure. But alluvial fans, we talked about those, that you can get sediment deposited on the beach. You can get sediment in deltas, in rivers, et cetera, right? So all that sediment's being transported from the source area, from the mountains, downriver, downstream to the delta, eventually to the ocean, right? And then the stream, we looked at this image as well, and I want to bring this back up because this is key to why placer deposits exist, gold placer deposits. So this is places where, again, you're panning for gold. You go to a stream and you pull up some of the sediment in the stream, you put it in a pan, you start shaking it. You're trying to find little flakes of gold in there. Why is it being concentrated in the streams? Well, if you think about it, the stream, as you move in different parts of the stream, there's different amounts of energy that are present. So when you go to the outer side, right, the cut bank, remember you have high velocities of water there. That's higher energy than on the inside, okay, on the point bar, right? And that's why you get deposition on the point bar and you get erosion on the cut bank. Because high energy flow out here, low energy flow in here. And the reason for that is because the water that moves along here doesn't have to travel very far to get to this location, while the water over here on the outside has to travel much further just to get to the same location downstream, right? So in order to get to the same location downstream, it has to travel faster, which just means there's more energy there, right? So it's eroding, et cetera. And so what this variation in kinetic energy within the stream is doing is it's taking different size grains and different grains with different densities, and it's sorting them. It's sorting them. It's like, oh, look, this one's really dense, and it can only stay in suspension in this energy level, this part of the stream. But as soon as it goes, the stream changes in energy level, it's going to come out of suspension. It's going to get deposited. And the only things that are going to get deposited there are going to be other grains with the same exact density, right? Anything that's a little bit lighter will keep on being transported downstream. It's not going to follow the suspension. Okay, so that's how gold is being concentrated in streams, right? It's gold's all going to have the same density, but its density is going to be different from other elements, which I have a table of. I'm going to show you in a second here. But this kind of shows the whole system. So you got your mother lode up in the mountains. That could be the Carlin-type deposit or any other, right? Epithermal deposit, etc. This is where it's exposed at the surface in the mountains. That's eroding, right? And that sediment comes down the streams here and eventually starts going through these meanders, and heavy gold settles out of the water when it slows down over rough areas in the stream bottom and as it goes around bends. So this is the point bar, right? This is the origin of placer gold. Okay. So that's pretty interesting. As I mentioned, I have a table of different elements here. So we have, you know, at the upper side here, these are low density metals. And then at the lower part, we have high density metals. And look, gold is at the bottom. Okay, so gold is going to be the heaviest and the densest of all these things, right? So it's the one out of all of these metals that are in suspension in that stream, right? If you have a lot of different grains of material and some of those are metals, gold is going to come out of suspension before all the others because it's heavier as that stream starts to slow down going around a turn, for example, right? On the inside, the point bar of that turn, gold's going to all start settling out together first because it's the heaviest, okay? And then as that current slows down a little bit more, then the lead will start settling out, then the silver, then the copper, et cetera. So the stream is this really amazing natural sorter of different grain types. Okay, it's concentrating the gold for you. That's the placer deposit, basically. Okay. Here's an image that shows sort of how this looked like for the California Gold Rush. So this is an image from 1875, and here's somebody panning for gold in one of these streams. You can see this would be in California here, and we're looking at Sierra Nevada, right? Motherlode veins are shown by these guys here. So again, it exists along a trend, right? It's going to exist along a trend here. And then you have all these rivers that come out, right? Sacramento's here, the Sacramento River, and a bunch of other tributaries to the Sacramento coming out of the Sierra Nevada. You have dredge fields. So these are areas where people are going into these larger river beds, and they're just dredging out all the sediment, and they're looking for gold in there. Okay, they're sorting it for gold, looking for it. You also have these dashed lines, which are the tertiary river channels. So what that means is these are ancient river channels, that are no longer active, but were active maybe in the last, 10,000 years, maybe the last 100,000 years. Okay, somewhat recently, in terms of geologic time recently, like within the last couple million years. Okay, so you have these other river channels, which are ancient river channels, and those might be exposed, and you can look at them. So, here's another kind of funny picture of some old people in California in the Gold Rush panning for gold. It was a big deal, right? The 49ers, right, comes from that. So we're panning for gold here. This is what kind of a modern pan would look like, and it has these little ribs on it. So you can, as you slosh this around, different grains of different densities will kind of settle out at different points within that pan. But you had what was real popular back in the day, hydraulic mining. Just get these hoses, and it's like a fire hose pretty much, and you just spray it on the side of your river channel, loose sediment there, and it just dislodges it. It just causes mass erosion ultimately and gets all that sediment moving downstream, okay? And so then that sediment starts moving downstream, then you can start sorting it and looking for gold, okay? Real insanely destructive way to mine for placer gold. It's really not done in modern operations much anymore. So Pleistocene river deposits, this would be an ancient river deposit, right? And you see these just driving around on highways and stuff. You'll see outcrops that look like this. This is just an ancient river deposit. Ultimately, you see all these cobbles and stuff in here. So, if you take your fire hose and you just spray it on this thing really hard, really high velocity water, it'll break this stuff up and cause it to erode away. It's basically what they're doing. Once you start to sort out your gold, you'll get some of those heavier elements like gold and lead and silver, etc. Those will start coming out, right? But you're really trying to concentrate just the gold. And so there's this process called mercury amalgamation. And this goes way back to the gold rush days. It's been used for a long time. Okay, and what you're doing ultimately is you're adding mercury, liquid mercury, right, to what you think your gold ore ultimately. And what the mercury does is it dissolves the gold. Okay, it puts it into solution with that mercury. So it's called amalgamation. It's also referred to as the patio process. You mix your ore with mercury. It dissolves the gold. And then after you dissolve it, then you take that mercury solution and you heat it. And what it does is it vaporizes the mercury and leaves behind the gold. Okay, so that's how you would be further refining your ore to concentrate your gold. The problem is, there's a bunch of problems, but one of the problems is mercury bioaccumulates. Okay, this is kind of a fancy word, but what it means is that as people were doing this out in the streams and such, as tons of mercury, they weren't like collecting that waste and putting it away responsibly. It was just going into the environment. So it bioaccumulates in the environment, and particularly fish, right? You end up with high mercury levels in your fish, which ends up being very, well, not just detrimental to the fish and the environment, but also to humans who are eating the fish. So all sorts of issues. You ended up in 1883, something called the California Debris Commission Act, which came about. And the reason that this happened wasn't so much because of the mercury. It was just because with all this hydraulic mining that was going on that was creating so much silt in the rivers, making them very turbid, right? They're just choked with silt. All that stuff would move downstream. And where would it go? Well, eventually to very populated areas like Sacramento and even all the way out to the Bay Area, to San Francisco. And that was a problem for the cities. They were like, you're totally polluting, you know, these large water bodies as you go out towards the ocean into these deltas. And so California, way back in the day, they passed this to restrict and regulate hydraulic mining. It's still done, right, by quite a bit by quote-unquote artisanal miners in other parts of the world, including Brazil, Ghana, Thailand. And this releases 100 million tons into the environment annually, which is a problem. And we're talking about mercury here, okay? This is amalgamation, which is also known as, the patio process, okay? Old school. It's been around for a long time, and it's still done. Okay, one of the more modern ways to do it, if you will, is by using these heap leach pads, which are shown in this image. You have these different terraces, right, that exist. Actually, let's look at this cartoon up here. So we have these different layers of rock. This would be your ore, okay? This is your gold ore. So you pile it up like this into these layers, and then you put a barrier, a water barrier at the bottom, okay? And then what you do is you spray cyanide. Not pure cyanide, but a dilute cyanide mixture ultimately all over this pile, and then it leaches through, and that cyanide ultimately dissolves the gold. Okay, and then it goes to the bottom of the pile here, and then it flows out somewhere in some outlet, and then you take that solution, and then you add zinc to it. Interestingly, and that zinc ends up causing the gold to precipitate out. Basically, here's another example of a heap leach pad. So you see all these large piles of your ore up here. The cyanide solution is being sprayed or poured over it. It slowly percolates through the pile, gets to the bottom here, and it kind of comes out right along these. You take that solution, and again, you extract your gold from that solution. So cyanide process dissolves gold from the ore, forming. Yeah, what they call that solution where you have gold in solution, they call it a pregnant solution, interestingly. And then you add zinc, which causes the gold and silver also to precipitate out. There is an international cyanide management code that was developed, and the reason for this is because there was a dam failure. Failure in a Romanian gold mine, which ended up releasing 100 metric tons of cyanide into a local river there in Romania. Total environmental catastrophe. So the international community came together, said, look, we need to put some guardrails on this. We need to regulate this. And there are states, well, Montana being one, there are places where the cyanide process is not allowed, where it's banned in Montana. And then also some countries just generally ban its use. So as you'll see in one of your videos, which is put out by a gold advocacy group, really. They say that it can be done very safely, but not all people agree, right? There are definitely risks, okay? So I'm going to go ahead and leave it there. We talked a little bit about, the many geologic environments in which gold can be formed, and then a little bit about its processing. So there's going to be a quiz to take, and then also some videos to watch, including a little bit of a discussion there. Hopefully you enjoyed that that little sort of tour of gold. It's a really fascinating one. That's the one we're going to focus on in terms of the precious metals. Then we'll move on to gemstones.